I'm Peter Suderman, and this is The Reason Rundown, the podcast to end your week. One Reason journalist, one big story, once a week. Thanks for listening. In August of 2021, President Joe Biden committed the United States to withdrawing combat troops from Afghanistan. After two decades of fighting, U.S. involvement in the war would finally be over.
I've concluded that it's time to end America's longest war. It's time for American troops to come home.
The withdrawal was chaotic and violent.
Our happiness is only going on with half of our body, because with half of our body, we are dancing, but from the other part, we are crying.
And in the years since, America's pullback from Afghanistan has produced new challenges. Among the biggest, how to resettle roughly 100,000 Afghan refugees uprooted by the war. Many of those refugees were not just people who lost their homes during the fighting. They were Afghan nationals who provided aid to the United States by acting as translators or guides for U.S. forces.
Can I send you some, like a name or something? I really need the help.
I've got all documents to go U.S. Please send our advice to President Joe Biden.
You might assume that there would be a political consensus, that the United States had an obligation to help rebuild the lives of its allies. But many Republicans, including former President Donald Trump, opposed large-scale resettlement operations. One Republican member of Congress warned that Biden's pullback from Afghanistan could become an excuse to flood the U.S. with refugees.
Are they doing a thorough vetting? Because we cannot have terror imported into the United States here.
There was, however, a clear exception to the GOP's opposition, the state of Utah. The state has a Republican governor, a Republican attorney general, and there's a Republican majority in the state legislature. Yet in the aftermath of the Afghanistan troop withdrawal, state and local officials were united in welcoming refugees.
We like first the people of Utah. They're very nice people here. When we faced any problem, they helped us a lot.
As it turned out, however, they faced their own obstacles from Congress, from the Biden administration, and from the labyrinth of America's immigration system.
They are not coming with a permanent immigration status. They're coming with a parole status, which is a very temporary immigration status.
I think it's just kind of in our DNA.
Has Utah ever felt overrun by refugees?
Not that I'm aware of.
My guest on the show today is Fiona Harrigan. Fiona is an assistant editor at Reason. She recently wrote a long feature about Utah's welcoming stance to Afghan refugees and its fights with the federal government about resettlement. Fiona, Utah wants to resettle Afghan refugees, but that's not as easy as it sounds. What are the obstacles here? Specifically, what are Congress and the Biden administration doing to make this process more difficult?
So I think there are two sides of this to consider. The first was on the front end, where we knew for a while that we would end up getting our troops out of Afghanistan, and we knew that that would come with some promises that had to be fulfilled. As you mentioned, there were a lot of Afghans who helped in translation and engineering and driving capacities, and they were afforded this special visa. So we knew that we had to evacuate these people, and that numbered in the tens of thousands. But they were put through a very complicated application process to secure these visas, and the backlogs numbered in the tens of thousands by the time the actual full withdrawal occurred.
So by the point that we, by August of last year, when Biden was like, we're out for good, when he was committing to this process that had been delayed and delayed and delayed, at that point, the backlog was already quite significant. This wasn't something that just built up after the fact, right?
That's correct. And this is a program that's existed since 2009, and immigration advocates would argue that it's been inefficient since the beginning, involving 14 steps that are very redundant, involving a lot of processing and putting these people in kind of this bureaucratic hell to actually get to the country. Which means that when we ended up beginning the evacuation process, and Biden announced this in August, we ended up evacuating 21,000 people in one day, just because there was such a buildup toward the end. And that ended up straining a lot of state systems because these people came to the country very, very, very suddenly. And then there was also this back end problem of resource scarcity, and these immigration agencies just didn't know how to handle these people so quickly because we'd never really had this massive influx so quickly.
So you mentioned the special visa here. That's the special immigrant visa, which goes to allies of the United States, people who have helped out often as translators. You also mentioned engineers, guides, that sort of thing. Tell me about the special immigrant visa. What is that designed to do? How well does it work? What are the problems with it?
Yeah, so I think there are a couple things that are important to mention about the special immigrant visa. And this is a visa that exists for Afghans and for Iraqis. So kind of part of our two biggest military engagements since the turn of the millennium. The special immigrant visa, it's meant to recognize the service that Afghans perform in support of the U.S. military mission in their country. It's kind of an implicit recognition that without them, the mission would be impossible because they serve in such critical liaison roles, but also a recognition of the danger that they often incur as a result of their service to the U.S. So a lot of translators, they'll be in the crosshairs of the Taliban for helping these Western forces.
And that was especially true during the withdrawal and afterwards, right?
That's absolutely correct.
That the target that was on their backs became more intense.
Right. And when you see these chaotic scenes of the airport and thousands of people gathering out front, the Taliban, they were operating checkpoints on the way to the airport and checking documents. They were raiding homes to see who was affiliated with the U.S. and in many cases torturing and injuring people who helped the U.S.
And there were bombings in the lines and the crowds of people trying to get out, right? I mean, this is those people, anyone trying to get out of Afghanistan during that time, their life was in danger, including U.S. troops, but especially, you know, people in Afghanis who had helped U.S. troops, and many of them. I mean, I've heard stories that are just kind of crazy about how they got out, about, you know, having to sort of ditch all of their belongings, go out under cover of night, you know, sort of go through these kind of darkened paths where avoiding people. It was an intense time, but now a lot of those people are here, and they've at least made it to the relative safety of the United States, but they are locked in a kind of uncertainty, right? Like they don't know what their lives are going to be like a year or two or 5 years from now. And tell me a little bit more about that uncertainty and what, you know, sort of what the barriers are there.
That's the other portion of the federal government's complication of this whole resettlement process, is that a lot of these people, they were in the application pipeline for the special immigrant visa, the SIV. About half of the people who ended up coming here were either holders or applicants to that visa. But about half of them didn't have that status and came here instead on something that's temporary. It's called humanitarian parole. And it's a 2-year status where they can work here and they are legally here, but not much else is certain about their status. So, for example, it doesn't have a pathway to citizenship or to permanent residency in the way that the SIV does, which means that now, without any kind of congressional or federal action, they're left with a lot of uncertainty, all of those people who were paroled into the country.
So that's 2 years. What does the life of someone look like that after that 2 years is up? What can they expect?
That's the open question. I think a lot of people are still asking where that leaves the new Afghans because it hasn't just been determined yet. Congress, they were deliberating these measures called the Afghan Adjustment Act. It's similar to other adjustment acts that we've passed previously to address large groups of refugees. People from Vietnam and Cuba, for example, were subject to adjustment acts to help them become citizens and have more certainty in their new country. Those haven't gone anywhere, though. They've been tacked on to certain legislative efforts, but they haven't been passed in any form so far. So really, a lot of people are still stuck in limbo and wondering how they can build a life if they don't know that they can stay here.
So a lot of those people are trying to build lives in Utah. And there's a reason for that. Utah's response, as I said earlier, has been somewhat unique. It's a Republican state. Republicans have pushed back on Afghan resettlement in part just because of a kind of generalized objection to immigration, in part because of the political angle, because they want to pin this on Joe Biden somehow and make this part of their political attacks on the Biden administration. But in Utah, that's not what's happening. So tell us what makes Utah different and what Utah is trying to do to help Afghan refugees settle in a more permanent way.
The most important place to start, I think, is Utah's history. Everybody in the state and to some degree or another, is very aware that the state founded as this collection of refugees, of religious and political refugees in a way, because it was founded by members of Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, LDS Church, or Mormons more colloquially, who were fleeing persecution on the East Coast. They were forced to move from state to state, from New York and then to Ohio and Illinois and Missouri, before eventually there was an extermination order put out on their group from the Missouri government, and they were forced to flee westward. Tons of persecution and religiously motivated criticism and discrimination back in those early days forced them to come to Utah. And I think they're still very, very conscious of that early history, very sympathetic to people who are fleeing similar circumstances or what they see as mirroring circumstances. So when you see governors in recent years resisting the Trump administration, for example, asking to bring in more refugees at a time when refugee admissions are at historic lows, those governors, they'll cite their own history and they'll say, we were founded as refugees and we would welcome the chance to welcome more neighbors. That sort of thing is really, really important. And it helps these new Afghans feel very welcome in the state. I think it's a thing that really translates to every level of society, from the governor's office to the volunteers to civil society organizations and every other religious organization in the state.
Among the reasons that Republicans outside of Utah have given for opposing Afghan resettlement is that they say these refugee programs let people into the country who might not be safe, who might be terrorists. And as we talked about, you know, there are terrorist operations in Afghanistan, and but the thing is that many of those have been directed at the people who are trying to escape. Is it a reasonable worry that these resettlement programs, which are, as you said, moving a lot of people through the system very quickly, 21,000 in one day, right? This was a rush to get people out. Is there anything to the Republican claim that, well, that is something that terrorists could exploit to put people who are hostile to the United States into America?
I think I would first break down the Republican sentiment toward Afghans. And I think it's important to clarify that there are two classes of Afghans who came: those who assisted the U.S. and Western forces to some degree, and then those who came here without that kind of experience, who were maybe at risk for some other reason, their gender, sexual orientation, religion, that sort of thing. So if you look at the polling, Republicans, about half of them favored bringing in the ones who assisted U.S. forces, whereas only a quarter support offering asylum to those other Afghans who didn't assist us. So that's an important thing to keep clear. But I do think that it's important to remember that there were these extreme vetting mechanisms that were put in place where an Afghan, in order to get here, if they hadn't gone through all of these security checks that were part of other visa application processes, they had to wait for vetting to occur on bases outside the country and then bases within the country. So really, before an Afghan could integrate into, we'll say, a normal American town, as opposed to just being on a military base in the U.S., their entire history was checked. They were examined for any links to terrorist organizations. They were just looked at up and down. To the point where really there hasn't been this massive uptick in violence. You haven't heard many incidents of Afghans doing terrible things in their new home. And these are huge numbers of people who arrived here. About, it's over 75,000 people. And really, we would know by now if there was this massive safety risk.
So there's very little evidence that refugees from Afghanistan are a risk for, you know, attacks against the United States.
Right. And I think you can kind of intuit that just based on the things that they had to go through to get here. Half of these people, they were assisting the U.S. military in some capacity, already putting their lives on the line for the American ideal and patriotism and all of that to a country they'd never even visited. And that's really important to remember, that they just incurred these risks. And you saw these scenes of people clinging to airplanes to get out of the country. Clearly, there was a desire to leave and a desire to be in a new place. And then they saw this as the place to be. And I think that it really factors into their risk calculation here.
Your story is about how Utah is especially welcoming, which is a little bit of a surprise because of the Republican, because of how dominant Republicans are in that state. But there's not every state is as welcoming. And it's not just Republican states that have been places where it's been quite hard for Afghanis to immigrate to. California in particular, the federal government actually put out a warning in 2021 saying, do not try to move to California. Tell me about that, and why did the federal government warn Afghani refugees to stay away from California?
A lot of these Afghans who arrived here, by virtue of being on a temporary immigration status, they didn't get any benefits from immigration agencies or from the federal government, which means that a lot of them are starting from nothing in terms of their finances. And the federal government, the State Department, explicitly warned them from going to California because it was just so expensive to be there. They couldn't afford housing, and there's an acute housing shortage there. Even going through Utah, you wouldn't think of that as the epicenter of America's affordability crisis, but every Afghan I talked to in Salt Lake City said that they had to wait a long time to secure anything approaching permanent housing. Often they lived with other people who they knew in the area. The guy I profiled in this piece, Azeem, he waited 2 months before he could actually be moved into a reliable unit. So that sort of thing was really scary for a lot of people in the early days and was a major barrier to them getting their footing in the new country.
Afghan refugees have come here and have gotten settled in some cases, but like you said, there's a lot of uncertainty. And there's also been a lot of uncertainty, not only for the people who have established lives here, but for people who have been trying to get here, including some of our partners, people who were translators, people who were who assisted U.S. forces. There is, I think there's a real concern amongst the community of people who have been tried to help with the refugees that this sort of thing degrades America's standing in the world. Right? These were folks who helped us out, who worked with us, who made a hostile foreign place less hostile, and in some cases they got left behind. How do you think this plays out in terms of? Just in terms on the global stage, right? What is this saying to the rest of the world about how America treats its partners and its allies?
I think it's a reliability issue, and I'm very against the idea of fighting another war like Afghanistan. But on the other hand, God forbid we do enter a war and need support in the way that we needed it for Afghanistan and for Iraq as well. It's hard to say that we'll be able to reap the kind of support that we were able to reap when we were in Afghanistan. Just people looking at this supposed benefit of assisting the U.S. forces and how difficult it was to come by. So really, it's, I think, a major sticking point and something that would be very difficult in that context.
For the people who have made it here, what are their lives like? You went out to Utah and you actually met some of these people and you talked to people who work for the resettlement agencies. Day to day, what's it like to have been uprooted like that and ended up in Salt Lake City?
I think there's a lot of trauma that comes with it. There's a lot of unresolved baggage that comes with fleeing the country. And I think a lot of the immigration agencies and their staff are now playing therapist in addition to playing community liaison and housing assistant and so on and so forth. And that's a really big thing to keep in mind. But on balance, economically and socially, these people are really thriving to the point where in Salt Lake City, the man I interviewed for this piece, he's already working as a housing coordinator for the immigration agency that helps a lot of other people settle in Utah, which is really, really impressive. He has a child already and a new car, better than anything I've ever driven. His family is all employed with the exception of his wife, who's taking care of the baby. But they've really integrated in some very impressive ways. People are just now starting to consider going back to school, obtain training, regain those certifications that don't translate across international lines. But by and large, they've really been welcomed. And now, after about a year of integration and of resettlement, these agencies, English language instructors and so on, they're beginning to address these things and regain their footing in a way that means everybody's kind of comfortable with the status quo, though they are still regaining some of their sanity after how quickly they had to accommodate these people last year. So I think that's a lasting memory and something that they hope not to repeat if we ever do have to resettle that many people that quickly again. But they're happy to do it, especially in Utah. I heard no complaints really on a meaningful level about the help that they've been kind of required to give by virtue of this circumstance.
Is there cultural conflict? I mean, there is some history of this, you know, in some ways just with the Mormons, right, who moved out to, you know, who settled Salt Lake City to begin with, is that their religious commitments and their beliefs put them at odds with sort of the rest of the United States in a lot of ways, certainly with the U.S. federal government. If you go back 20 years or so, you know, after 9/11, there was certainly conflict with, you know, Middle Eastern communities with Muslims and the rest of the United States. Are we just not seeing that at all?
I asked everyone I interviewed for this piece where the protests were, where the resistance was, any of those things. Was there vandalism? Were you ever discriminated in the grocery store? On and on and on. And everybody gave me a no, essentially. There was one person I interviewed toward the end who said that in the smallest towns and the smallest settings, that occasionally she would get somebody saying, well, how can you support these open border policies? That's about as serious as it ever gets. But by and large, these people are just accepted round and round. And I think part of that just comes from the fact that Utahns still see themselves as very distinct. They know that they were persecuted and they're very, very aware of that history to the point where they really want to help these people themselves and recognize that difference. And also the Afghans who came to Utah, they mentioned the things they love about Utah, and it's a lot of the things that they loved about Afghanistan and their own cultures. So they're very conservative socially. They're very moderate in terms of substance, right? Utah, by virtue of the religion, there's not much drinking, not much drug use. It's a very clean society. They like those things about being in kind of practicing Muslim circles. And they love the economic mobility and they love the scenery and all of those things. So for Utahns, it feels kind of like this reminder of their past in many ways to help refugees. And for the Afghans, it feels like the best parts of home, of the country that they had to leave behind when they reach Utah.
It does always feel like a sort of a political own goal for Republicans to oppose immigration like this, because when you look at where it has actually happened, you know, where refugees are being resettled, they fit into the communities. They contribute to the economy. They work, right? They're not committing violence, and they are supporting a lot of the kind of the more conservative, you know, socially conservative policies that like you and I might not even be, you know, too favorable to. But like these are people who are going to come in and maybe not necessarily be super hardcore Republican voters in the sense of, you know, the Deep South Republicans, but at the same time are modeling a kind of conservative lifestyle that Republicans say they want to support. So last question here is just about the sort of more general politics of this. There are people who look at the chaotic withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan, at the refugee situation, at the return of Taliban control, the violence there, and they say, well, maybe we shouldn't have pulled out of Afghanistan at all. Maybe we should have kept troops there for another 5 or 10 or even 20 years, if that's what it took. What do you say to that?
I think at a certain point, you have to wonder what 21 years would have accomplished that 20 years didn't, and so many billions of dollars and lives lost. But in the immigration sense, I just think it would have kicked the can down the road. Clearly, there was a lot of federal foot dragging that wasn't going to get resolved in a clean way because there were so many opportunities for Congress or for executive powers to take some action to really clean up the system and make it easier for people to come here who should have been able to come here by virtue of what we promised them. Those things I don't think should have been used as a justification to stay longer. I think it would have led to a lot more destruction and a lot more devastation. And at a certain point, a lot of this was just inevitable by virtue of how the federal government chose to handle things.
Thank you so much. That's all the time we have for this week. If you want to learn more about Utah's quest to resettle Afghan refugees, you can read Fiona's article, Utah Wants to Help Afghan Refugees Prosper. Will the federal government get in the way? As always, if you like this show, please remember to subscribe and recommend it to friends. And if you like Reason's work generally, you can support us at reason.com/donate. That's reason.com/donate. I'm Peter Suderman, and this has been The Reason Rundown.